Thanks, Andy.
Hello, everyone. My name's John and I'm an addict. And thank you, Mickey. Can you hear me, Mickey? Good man. Thank you, Mickey, for asking me to come and share. And thank you for the meeting, Annie. Anyone that does service. Not everyone, anyone that does service. And hopefully tonight I'll carry the message of Narcotics Anonymous. And if I upset anyone with anything that I say, and or I offend anyone with anything I say, I apologise now, because, you know, as an addict, I can upset people by the way that I talk or by the way that I act or other things, you know. And, I'm a bit tired. I've travelled 140 miles today to come and do this share. And I'm not saying that because, you know, for people to think, oh, isn't he a wonderful person? That's what I do. I do service anywhere that anyone asks me to do service. And that's a change. And thank you, Debbie, for what you had to say. Thank you. And I don't know the exact date, time or whatever, but I know on the 29th of November this year, it's 7 years since I had an illegal drug or an alcoholic drink. And it wasn't like that for a long time, 27 years. And all I can do is tell you my truth and my experience, you know. My experience of using Class A drugs from the age of 14 right up until I went into a treatment centre at the age of 38. And then I'll tell you a bit about my journey from the treatment centre to today. And as some addicts, not all addicts, mine started with glue and gas, you know, sniffing gas and sniffing glue and solvents. And I progressed to weed and hash and you know, and it just progressed and progressed and progressed. And in that time, I caused a lot of harm, damage and pain to a lot of people, including myself. I've been in every top security jail in the country, Cat A jail in the country, and I've been in most of the Cat B jails as well. When I was a kid, I was locked up for 3.5 years, and I'd done every day of that. And that was because of an incident where I was high on cocaine, and I used a car to injure people, and the charge was conspiracy to murder. And I'd done every day of that 3.5 years. And I come out and I thought I knew better, and I smoked weed and I snorted cocaine and I drank alcohol. And I kind of lasted, how I lasted, I don't know, but I lasted a little while until I was 24. And again, I was locked up when I was 24, and when I came out, I was 35. And during that time, I abused a lot of women, you know, not physically, but mentally, emotionally and spiritually. And I'm glad to say I've got a wonderful woman in my life. She's sitting in the room tonight, and we're getting married in September. And she's my fiance, but she was one of them women that I abused over 20-odd years ago. And, there's a gentleman in the room tonight that was in Brixton Prison with me 20-odd years ago, and he kind of knew the character that I was then, and he's totally different today. You know, I'll... No disrespect to shoplifters, burglars, muggers, whatever. You know, I don't do that kind of thing. I smoke thousands of pounds worth of crack a day. And in order to do that, I will commit armed robberies. I will tie people up in mansions. I will do anything to get my drugs. And today I will do anything and everything to stay clean. And I'm a bit upset, and I'll share this. I wasn't going to share it, but I'm a bit upset because one of my pals that I've been trying to help and came into the meeting earlier on tonight, he's a day clean. And... You know, he says it's on him, and he don't know how to do this, and he don't know how to do that. And he had 5 years under his belt before. And in the break, I kind of said, where's he gone? He's gone. And if you see me shutting my eyes when Debbie was sharing, it wasn't because I was falling asleep or because I'm tired. It's because I was connecting to a power that I choose to call God, and I was praying for him. And that's changed as well. And I've got no qualms in believing in God, you know, because for many years... I had no qualms in believing in the devil and doing the devil's work, you know. And, I caused so much damage, so much pain that, it kind of left me feeling guilty, left me feeling remorseful, left me feeling shameful. And I've had every diagnosis under the sun, you know. I've been in Rampton, you know. I went into Rampton and they said they was going to assess me. And I was there for 5 years. And then they told me that I was never getting out. You're here indefinitely. And I've been diagnosed as a schizophrenic. First of all, I was diagnosed at 14 with borderline personality disorder. You know? Then they said I was a schizophrenic. and what they now call bipolar, it was manic depressive. They said I was a manic depressive. Because if I couldn't harm you, I'd harm myself, you know. I've cut myself and things like that, self-harm. And then the latest one that they gave me was schizoid affective disorder. But the one that I was in Rampton for, they said I was a psychopath, because when I smoke crack cocaine, my behaviour is psychopathic, and you know, and that's how I perform, you know. And it ain't like that, thank God, you know, a day at a time, it ain't like that today, and it ain't like that, it ain't been like that for many years. So anyway, I get discharged, I win a tribunal, because I proved that they flew in some professor from America that does this score sheet thing, and if you score 47 more on this score sheet, they say you're a psychopath. And this man deals with serial killers, and you know, he's wrote books with Ted Bundy, and they flew him in from America to assess me. And if you score 47 or more, then you're deemed to be a psychopath and a danger to society. And I scored 17. They couldn't hold me no more. They couldn't hold me no more. They had to let me go. And that's it, yeah, they let me go. But, you know, I never knew about Narcotics Anonymous, and I never knew about the other fellowships. Because I'm a gambler, I'm a drinker, I'm a womanizer. You know, my addiction comes out in many ways. You know, there's a saying, you put down the spoon, you pick up the fork. You know, I've been fighting fit at 14 stone 8 pound, and 2 years ago I was 34 stone 9 pound. You know, and today I'm 25 stone because I had to do something about my weight and my eating, and it comes out in many other ways, many other ways. My addiction, you know, it's kind of a known thing where I come from, which is I come from Northeast London originally, a place called Hackney. But I live in a place called Clevedon, which is in between Western Supermare and Bristol. That's where I come from today. And it's kind of a well-known thing that I always smell nice, and I've always got nice trainers. You know? And I'll be in a shop, and I've got a tray at home, and there's people that have been to my flat, and they can confirm it. Not that it needs confirming, but I've got a tray at home of aftershaves, and I'll be in a shop, and I don't need no aftershaves. Please believe me, I don't need no more aftershave. And I'll look, and some of them are doubles as well. I'll look, and I think... And I'll justify it by saying, it's a bargain. And I don't need it. Same as the trainers, you know. I don't need it. And it comes out in many ways. But what this stuff allows me, these books are basic things, how and where, yeah. And the literature, it shows me a way to live, you know. And a way to put this stuff into my life and try and live a spiritual life. You know, where I try and help as many people as I can. Not just addicts and alcoholics, but anyone. And, I got out in 2002 after being detained for 10 years, 8 months. And I've heard it shared in many meetings. Instead of going right and doing the right thing, I went left and I smoked crack and heroin again. And again, it wasn't long. That lasted 3 years. And in all that time that I was incarcerated, I smoked crack and I smoked... Maybe not as much as when I was on the street, but you know what? I didn't have no problem getting crack and heroin in jail. Or ecstasy, or acid, or, you know. And if I couldn't get anything, I'd kick off, and they'd go, give him Valium, for fuck's sake, calm him down. You know, and I'd take anything and everything. And, that lasted 3 years, and again, it wasn't long before I got in trouble again, I got arrested. But this time, there was a change, because when I'm doing what I'm doing in active addiction, and excuse my language, I don't mean to swear, but I kind of justify it by saying I'm emphasising, you know. And then when I'm doing what I'm doing in active addiction, I don't give a fuck about none of you, and I don't give a fuck about me. But I care about my mum deeply, and I care about my dad, and I care about my sisters, and I care about my daughter. And when I got locked up, my then partner was pregnant, and when I got out, I had a 12-year-old girl, you know. And it's only in the last 7 years that I built a relationship with that girl. And a beautiful girl, her name's Chelsea, and thank God, you know, she's not an addict. And I had a foster brother, you know, and I tell everyone that he was my brother, because he was my brother. And when I was in Whitemore Prison, which is a top security prison in Cambridgeshire, when I was in there, I got a phone call from my best mate. And he said, his nickname was Slippery. His name was Gavin. He said, Slippery's gone. I said, where's he gone? Because he was always going all over the country. And he said, no, he's gone, man, he's gone. I said, what do you mean he's gone? He said, he's dead. And that was Valium and Cider. And didn't stop me. And that guy that made that phone call that day, you know, A few years I was clean. I was clean and sober, and I'd come up to London and I'd see him, and he was still at it. And the way that this disease got him is that he couldn't stop using it, and he took his own life. He hung himself. And that's the truth, you know. And I don't want to end up like that. So this is why I do this stuff. But anyway, yeah, I just thought I'd, you know, because I tried to talk about them, to remember them, you know, because they were my brothers, man. And, so I got arrested again, and the officers went round to tell my mum that I'd been arrested, she had a heart attack. So I'm in Belmarsh Prison on remand, and the priest comes. And when the priest comes, you know, he either comes to tell you that someone's died, or he comes to tell you that you got a chapel visit. It ain't good news. It can be good news or bad news. And I'd only been in there a couple of days, and he comes, and I knew it was saying bad, and he told me, yeah, your mum's in hospital, she's had a heart attack, blah, 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 life support machine. So I said, I need to see the governor. And the governor comes, and I tell the governor, don't ask the governor, I tell him, I said, listen, let me tell you something now. I said, this is how it's going to be. If you don't take me to see my mother and she dies, I'm telling you now, I'm going to kill a prison officer. And there ain't been a prison officer killed in this country for 42 years. And I said, that's what I'm going to do. And he said, there's no need to do that, you're going at 2 o'clock this afternoon. and I kind of said, well, I was only joking anyway. Yeah, so anyway, yeah, they took me to see my mother in Homerton Hospital in North London, and she was all this breathing apparatus, blah blah, you know, and things beep beep beep, and I took my mother's, and this is as true as I sit here today. I took my mother's hand in my hand, and I said, Mum, my family called me John John. I said, Mum, I said, it's John John. Please wake up, Mum. I'll do anything. Please wake up. And there and then she come out of the coma, man. And she said, John, John, you need to sort yourself out. And I brought some people down from Western Supermare, some newcomers and some other people, a bit of clean time. And they were talking to my mum today. They met my mum, and she was kind of telling them things that I got up to and that when I was using. And I said, Mum, I said, you know what, Mum? I said, like, I'm in Belmarsh Prison. I said, you know what I was doing at 8 o'clock this morning? She said, what was that, John, John? I said, I was smoking heroin in Belmarsh. And the prison officers are sitting there. They can hear this. I said, I'm in top security prison, I'm smoking heroin, that's what I was doing at 8 o'clock this morning before I come to see you. I said, I want to stop and I can't stop. And she said, okay, we need to get help. And I beat the case that I was arrested for, I was found not guilty. But what they done, they held me and they transferred me to a psychiatric unit. And a lovely lady called Sue Watts, I often talk about her, a lovely, lovely lady from social services called Sue Watts, came and interviewed me and assessed me for a residential treatment. And 6 weeks later, I went to a treatment centre. And when I went in that treatment centre, you know what, in 1995, there was a riot in Whitemore Prison, you know, and the IRA escaped from there the year before, and they used a gun to get out. But there was a three-day riot, and there was a news blanket on it. It never got televised until 5 days later. And we caused £700,000 worth of damage. And I was the ringleader. I was one of the ringleaders in that riot. And there were seven of us standing on a landing, and there were 64 prison officers, because it was all locked, because it went to court. And I wasn't frightened. I wasn't frightened. You know, I've been in situations where guns have been put on my head. I've shot guns, I've fired guns, I've been shot at, blah, blah, blah. And I've never been frightened. And when I went into that treatment centre, I was scared. I was frightened. You know, I was frightened. And what Debbie said about getting vulnerable, I was a frightened little boy, you know. Because I'm used to running around landings, you know, and running around streets and talking Cockney rhyming slang and prison rubbish, you know. I'm used to that. You know, but I'm not used to being around people that care for me and really want me to get well and show me love. And it was the only treatment centre in the country to accept me because of my history, my forensic history and my criminal background. And I was in that treatment. You're meant to do 5 months treatment there, and there's a couple of people in the room that are just, they're a week out of that treatment centre. And you're meant to do 5 months treatment there, but I've done 8 months, nearly 9 months I've done there. Because again, because of my history and my past, I couldn't get a recovery house. Some people call them dry houses. The house that I went to, I like to call a recovery house, because that's what I've done there, I recovered there. And I was there nearly 9 months, and then I went to a dry house. And 6 weeks after leaving treatment, I'd done all sorts of workshops. I learned about the steps, and it's totally different in treatment, the steps to the green and gold, and the steps to the other fellowships that I attend, and that I'm a member of, totally different, the steps that they taught me in there, and there was lots and lots of writing, a bit like the green and gold, but there was lots and lots of writing, There was lots and lots of looking at the consequences, lots and lots of looking at the harms. And to be totally honest with you, I wasn't honest in there. I wasn't 100% honest. I only let them know what I think that they could handle. Because I had all that gear going on in my head. If I tell this guy, this counsellor, if I tell this guy this, that and the other, I would definitely never get out. I know they're going to call the old bill for this one. And so, I wasn't totally honest. But what they told me in there, they told me that when I left there, I needed to get a sponsor. And he said in the reading earlier, I needed to attend as many meetings as possible. And I needed to go through the work, and I needed to do service and help others and get a home group and things like that. And when I left that treatment centre, I was frightened. And I said to my counsellor, I said, you know what? I said, I'm going to die, man. I can't make this. I can't do this. And he said, listen, I'm telling you now. Do exactly what I tell you. I said, I'm willing. He said, go out there and get a sponsor. I said, okay, I'll do that. He said, get a home group. And I done that. He said, go through the work, blah, blah, blah. And I went out, and I think it was 6 weeks after being out of treatment, I was sitting in the rooms and I was listening and I was watching everything I was taught and told in treatment. And there's a lovely, lovely man. And, you know, he's my sponsor today, and he's been my sponsor since day dot. You know, I've had the same sponsor. And he took me through the work, and he kind of showed me and told me what I suffer from, and told me how to arrest it a day at a time, and how to live life, and try and be a better person and a good person. And I remember going to a charity shop, and I was in this recovery house, and I didn't know. I was 38 years of age, and I never had a bank account. I dealt in readies, cash, you know, readies there and then, you know. Didn't want no banks, and even now today, my fiance says, "Well, if you go on the internet, fuck the internet, I ain't interested. Go to the cash point, get the readies out, and give it to you." You know, I don't trust the internet, and I'm not interested in telephone banking and all that readies. I never knew nothing about computers. I never knew nothing about laptops. A mobile phone was a crack token, you know, and that's how I still am today sometimes. And I'm glad people are laughing. You know what? When Mickey said to me a couple of months ago, John, I like what you said in the meeting. Would you come and share? I said, yeah, Mickey. And I'm in the shower the next day. I'm saying, should I tell him about the time in Camden Town when I had a shootout with PT-17? And should I tell him the time when I took the geezer out? I got a minicab to Maidstone Prison and I got away with a cab fare because I introduced the geezer to Reggie Cray. And all this madness, you know? But yeah, I'm glad people are laughing. Yeah, so I went in this recovery house, and it was suggested that I do some computer courses, basic computer courses, and I went and learned about computers, and I got a certificate. And apart from treatment, it was the first thing that I completed, something so simple. And it was about keeping it simple in the beginning, you know. It was about getting out of bed and showering and making sure that I had breakfast. And I don't shave, but, you know, making sure that my clothes were ready. And even if I had nowhere to go, nothing to do, get out and walk and meet people and connect with other addicts and other alcoholics, you know. Simple things in the beginning. And that's how I got by. And then he said to me, go and do some voluntary work in a charity shop. So I said, yeah. I said, what do you want me to do? He said, go to Age Concern. He said, and ask him, can you help? I said, okay, I'll go and ask. So they got me in this room, yeah. I've been in bigger cells, right? They got me in this room. There's no windows. I'm opening up bags, and some of the stuff that I'm finding ain't too healthy. Yeah, they give me a steamer, and they're telling me steam them clothes, you know. And I'm getting resentful. I'm getting angry. I'm on the phone every 2 minutes to my sponsor. I'm being mugged off here. And I fucking robbed banks and jewelry shops and security vans. And fucking standing. He went, do it. So I done it, and I done it for 6 months. And then when after the 6 months, I phoned him. I said, listen, I'm getting, this is taking the piss now. And he said, all right. He said, go and ask the woman. He said, go and ask the woman, can you work on the till? I said, okay. So I go and ask the manager. I said, is there any chance that I can do the shop floor and go on the till? She went, yeah. I tell you now, that till was never one penny under and not one penny over. People would come up and they say, keep the child. I said, there's a charity box there. Put it in there. You know? And I done that for another 6 months. But during that time, I tried to educate myself, and I was 29 years of age before I learned to read and write, and I learned to read and write in Barker's prison on the Isle of Wight. And today I'm sitting here today, I've got a GCSE English, I've got a GCSE maths, I've got a counselling certificate, blah, blah, blah. Passed my driving test. I've been driving cars since I was 10 years of age. And I've got a full, clean, legal driving license. I've got my own vehicle. And that's because I do this stuff. But yeah, so I've done that for another 6 months, and then I've done other bits and pieces of voluntary work, like trying to help out other people, meeting other addicts and coming to the house, a bit of mentoring. And then an opportunity come up to work with young offenders in Western Supermare. And I went and done all the training. And they said, we're going to send off for your CRB. And they knew all about me. I told them because the police are involved, prolific offending team, probation and things like that. And I told them all about me. And they went, yeah. I said, I'm telling you, when you get the CRB, you know, there's a few things on there you might not like. And they went, yeah. And then when they got the CRB, they paid for me to all this training. They said, you know what, actually, you can't work here. You know, we've had a look at your CRB and you can't work here. But anyone that's got any convictions for whatever it is, you know, you can get a job and you will get a job, you know what I mean? You can get employed. And I've got convictions of discharging a firearm with intent to resist arrest, discharging a firearm with intent to endanger life, robbery, grievous bodily harm, you name it. I've been convicted of most of them crimes. And I'm sitting here today and I've got two part-time jobs. And the treatment centre that I've got clean out, I now work there as a support worker. And because of my experiences in top security mental hospitals and medium secure unit hospitals and things like that, I'm a support worker with an organisation in Bristol working with vulnerable people with mental health issues. And I know that I'm good at what I do. I'm told more often than not I'm good at what I do. And you know what, if this thing wasn't working here now and you said, John, you need to change the plug, I say, no, we need to phone an electrician, you know? But if you say, John, you know that guy over there is really struggling, or that woman over there is really struggling around, say, I'll get a solution and I'll get a positive out of any negative, because I'm good with people. I never used to be, but I'm good with people. And I kind of, that's been in me for many, many years, but I've only tapped into it since I got clean, you know? I'm not a bad man, you know? I'm not a bad man. I'm a good man. I'm a sick man getting well on a daily basis. I've done some terrible things, really, really bad things, but I know I'm not a bad man. And some of the things, even clean and sober for 4.5 years, and my fiance is there. You know, I had terrible nightmares, you know, reliving some of the things that I've done. Paranoid that people were coming for me. And because of the things that I've done, I used to think, well, you know, no one can really have a go at me. They'll come for my family and this, that and the other. And I kind of had it with individuals, like hanging around and worked for certain individuals that, you know, they're involved in organised crime and so on. And I've been under psychiatric care for 21 years. You know, I've been under psychiatric care. I've been involved with psychiatrists, CPN, which is a community psychiatric nurse. I've been on medication 20 years, you know. Mood stabilizers, antipsychotics, and anyone that's on any medication in here for whatever ailment, right, or whatever disease, I'm not telling you that you've got to stop your medication. Please, I'm not a doctor. I'm just telling you my experience about working the 12-step program, having a loving God in my life, doing service, and having a sponsor. This is my experience. You know, I've been on, like I said, 20 years. I've been on medication. One form or the other, tablets. 13 years I've been on what they call depot medication, injections that you get either once a week or once a month, you know, or once a fortnight. And it can be, I've been on the maximum and then I've been on the minimum. And I'm sitting here today and it's 4 months since I've had any form of medication, you know. And like I said, anyone that takes any medication in here, you know, if you need to take medication, that's okay with me. I don't know about other people and I don't really care. But that's okay if you need to take medication. Because I had all that going on when I was in treatment. I'm not clean, I have to take medication. And my counsellor said it's prescribed. You know, you don't abuse it, it's administered by a professional. You're okay. You know. And but that's my experience, you know. 20 years of medication, one form or the other. You know, tablets. And that's all sorts. There ain't a medication that I haven't had. Any antipsychotic you want to name, I've had it. And there's a couple of reports that a professor wrote about me. And in one of them, he turned around and said, I don't know how this man is still standing, let alone fighting the nursing team, because I'm quite aggressive and violent. And in the other report, he wrote, this man will be on maximum doses of medication for the rest of his life and will never be gainfully employed. Fuck you, man. You know, I'm living proof, you know, I'm living proof. And you know what? There's a lot of differences. There probably is a lot of differences. You know, some of you guys and girls may not have been to jail. Some of you guys or girls may not have been involved in crime. But you know what the similarity is? We're all sitting here because in one way or the other, we've got a problem with drugs or alcohol, you know. And I'm kind of proud, you know. And people keep banging on to me, you know, professionals, when they hear my story and they hear some of my tales. They keep banging, John, you should write a book. And, you know, and a typical addict form, I got Ray Winston playing me. You know? I got Al Pacino as my brother. You know? But, you know, I got a wonderful, wonderful life. And don't get me wrong, you know, I'm not no spiritual guru. You know, a couple of Wednesdays ago, you know, I really went into a meeting and I let rip, you know. And that sort of stuff was for my sponsor. But what this program allows me to do is to go back to that meeting and make amends to that group and to the certain individuals that I kind of judged, you know, and kind of called them names and things like that. And it allows me to not hang on to a resentment, you know, not hang on to be bitter and twisted. And my sponsor Ted said to me about a massive resentment that I had, you know, with a certain individual. And he said, you're walking right. He said, he can't feel a thing. Yeah. I mean, you're the one who's feeling it. And resentment is when I've done a step four and five, you know, and I went and I looked at my defects. And I had massive resentments with prison officers. And my sponsor said, you need to do prison service. Yeah. I said, don't fuck up, man. He said, you need to go and do some prison service, boy. I went, all right, I'll go and do it. And, you know, the feeling that I got, I had to be interviewed by the security governor at Horfield Prison in Bristol. Bristol, HMP Bristol is also known as Horfield. And I went there and I'd done prison service. And the day that I come out, and during my sentence, you know, I was a high-risk Cat A prisoner for many years. And when they had Cat A's, they don't have them there at Bristol anymore, but when they had Cat A's, I went through there three times, you know. And the feeling that I got going in, you know, and talking to them guys and telling them guys, you know, about my experiences and what I'm doing today. You know, and I've met guys coming out of that jail. I've met them at the gate and, you know, took them to a meeting and tried to show them a bit of love. And, you know, and some of them people are still clean and sober today with a few years under their belts, you know. And, yeah, fantastic. I love this gear. I'm drying up. This stuff works, you know, this stuff works. I'm living proof. I was written off, you know. I was written off by probation. I was written off by the prison authorities. I was written off by professors and psychiatrists. And I'm a productive member of society today, as it says in the readings, you know. We worked it out. Me and the chief executive of the treatment centre that I work at, we worked it out. Just being incarcerated, just having me locked up, I cost the government £4 million. Over that 10 years, you know, they spent, I think it was 38 or 39, when we looked at it, because we went back through the archive, I think it was £39,000 for the 8 months treatment. Since that, I ain't cost the government a penny, you know, and I kind of battle on a daily basis, trying to get people treatment, trying to get people detoxes, you know, and sometimes it can be hard work, and sometimes it can lead me to getting angry and frustrated, and you know, because people die, you know, people die, and it's sad, and I'm talking like that, and I'm thinking about my pal that's just left the meeting, and I know, you know, people are on their journeys and people are on their paths, And I don't believe some, you know, I hear some people saying you can't carry the addict and you can only carry the message and you can't carry the alky, you can only carry the message and so forth. You know, sometimes we need carrying, man. You know, sometimes we need carrying. Because I was carried, you know, I was carried a few times, you know. I remember phoning up my sponsor at 4 o'clock in the morning when I was in the recovery house. And for whatever reason, I wanted to go to Bristol News. And I phoned up, I said, you got a cab number? 4 o'clock in the morning. Hello, you got a cab? He said, we're not fucking cab for. I said, I need to get to London. He said, no, no, no. And he knew. And I kind of got a similar relationship with my fiance. She looks at me and she knows, you know. She knows, she's known me a long time. My sponsor hasn't known me as long as my fiance, but he knows me, you know. I'm grateful for this program. I'm grateful for my sponsor. I'm grateful to my higher power that I choose to call God, that I've got a connection with. And I'm grateful to you guys, you know. And because I couldn't do this without you guys. I couldn't do this on my own. And everyone is on a journey and everyone is on a path. I'm a great believer in that. And it don't matter how many treatment centres you go to, how many detoxes you do. Me personally, I done one detox in one treatment centre. But it doesn't matter how many you do. You know, as long as you do it and keep doing it, you know. And there's a saying, like they say, keep coming back, you know. My sponsor says, don't keep coming back, stay. Stay here, man. Stay here. And I'm kind of sad because my pal Alex, he ain't here. He's gone wherever he's gone. But you know what, he's on his journey and he's on his path and he knows that I'm there for him 24/7. But yeah, it's been a lovely meeting and thank you, Mickey. Yeah, I believe that I've got another brother, you know, because at the end of the day, sometimes I go on Facebook and I put little things on Facebook and, you know, we're not here to fight and kill each other, man. You know, we're here to love and help each other, you know, and there's enough wars and famine and, you know, madness going on in the world. And I'm a great believer in karma, you know, and what you reap is what you sow. Because you know what, for 27 years, you know, like I said, I worked for the devil, and I've done nothing good, nothing. And that's all I got back was bad. You know, that's all I got back. And since I've been clean and sober, I've tried. I'm not saying every day, but I've tried to be the best person that I can on a daily basis. And I truly believe, that I've helped a lot of people. You know, and that ain't my ego talking and my arrogance. That's a fact. You know, I've helped females that ain't not allowed anywhere near their children, and I've sat with them and I said, you need to do this and you need to do that and you need to do this. Not a sponsorship yet. This is in the treatment center, you know, and they come back to the reunion because every year at the treatment center we have a reunion, you know, and they come back, you know, and they come walking up the drive with their kids, you know, and I cry and I'll end on this because I've only got a couple of minutes, you know. I was involved in Saint one time and £1 million was involved, £1 million cash was involved and my whack was 360 grand, three of us, 360 grand each. And I shared about it in the treatment centre to these guys and girls, and a couple of weeks later I'd done a share in Trowbridge in a wheelchair and one of the guys was in there and he said, I remember you sitting down in secondary unit telling us about the time when you done what you done and then you got the £1 million cash. And he said that £1 million was a buzz. It took us 5 hours to count the money. And then he said, it's nothing to the way you feel when you see them people come back at the reunion. You know? And listen, thank you so much for inviting me here tonight. This is the first time I've been to this meeting. And like I said, I'll do service anyway. I'll do, you know, if they say to me, go to Kathmandu and do service, I won't say to them, are you paying for the ticket? I'll get the ticket. I'll be provided somehow. And thanks for letting me share. And if there's anyone new or anyone back off a relapse or anyone in this room that ain't even clean, you know, you can get this gear, man, if you want it. Thank you so much. God bless you all. Thank you.